sleep, but I wasn't going to manage that for a while. I mixed up chocolate chip cookies, just a double batch. I heard the murmur of Lucia's voice in the suite she shared with Hoel. There was no answering voice. Hoel had not managed to shift to human for the past few days. Aiden's fire had rekindled itself, but it wasn't up to normal levels yet, and he hadn't been able to quiet the volcano spirit enough to allow Hoel to emerge. That was a little disheartening, because we'd been hoping that Hoel had been gaining more control. Apparently Aiden had been getting better at shutting Hoel's fire down instead. At least Hoel had been able to stay in his Presa Canario form so we didn't have to worry about him burning down the house inadvertently. The sounds of me making food in the kitchen lured Medea out of whatever dark corner she'd been sleeping in. She hovered around my ankles because she knew that hopping on the counters was forbidden. I gave her a small dab of dough before I mixed in the chocolate chips and walnuts. She purred as she ate, and the sound soothed me. Cats are good company when you are sad or worried. Walnuts were a matter of contention in the pack, but I liked them, and I was making these for me. I needed chocolate because Adam wasn't here, and because it was taking a very long time for Ben to walk out and hand over a blanket. Adam's SUV purred into our driveway about the same time that the back door opened and Ben walked in, sans blanket. "What took so long?" I asked, trying not to listen to Adam's door shut. Now that Adam was actually here, I was nervous. What if he was unhappy when he saw me? I didn't want the sight of me to make Adam unhappy. "I will trade information for cookie dough," Ben bargained, so it wasn't anything bad that had kept him. I got a clean spoon from the silverware drawer, dipped it into the dough, then held it out toward him. When he reached to take it, his long sleeve slipped down to reveal two small red marks on his wrist. And from those two marks, faint wisps of smoke emerged. Aiden had identified our foe from the smoke that had apparently emerged from my wounds after the rabbit had bitten me. At the time, I'd been too busy trying not to die to pay attention to much of anything else. I now understood what Aiden had been talking about. My heart stopped. Ben had been bitten by the smoke beast. I pretended not to see the marks, hoping that my sudden terror went unnoticed, blended as it was with the adrenaline already racing in my veins after the sight of a naked wolf on the roof of my old rabbit. I didn't know enough to save Ben, not nearly enough. I knew the smoke beast took over its victims' bodies and piloted them. I knew that it used those victims to kill others to gain power, and that it then killed its puppet and could shape itself into a copy of that person. I had no idea what it wanted or why. I had no idea how to save someone bitten by the beast. And if I couldn't figure it out, Ben was lost. And I didn't know that I could bear a world without our foul-mouthed wolf. First problems first, I decided. First problem was to survive the next few minutes. Ben was a werewolf. That meant he was stronger than I was, and he outweighed me. Unlike George, Ben was significantly slower than I was. Maybe I could get him to chase me into the river. I heard Adam's footsteps on the porch, but Ben, licking the spoon clean, seemed oblivious. I gave a hard, panicked tug on my mating bond, and the sound of Adam's approach stopped. I had to hope that he had understood that there was something wrong. "Want some with chocolate chips?" I asked. He handed the spoon back to me. I dumped in a bag of chips and stirred with my bigger spoon before dipping his teaspoon in the mix, ignoring sanitary issues in favor of keeping him distracted. Adam hadn't just come in through the door, so I had a reasonable hope that I'd warned him enough. But what would allow him to connect my warning to Ben? Ben closed his eyes, absorbing the buttery sweetness and bitter chocolate combination. Was there a difference in his expression? Or was it just that I knew that someone else might be home inside Ben's head that made me think so? Could I be mistaken? Was this Ben? "So, what's the information you owe me?" I asked when his eyes opened again. He took a step closer to me, and I had to fight my instincts that would have sent me scuttling to the far side of the kitchen. "What do you want to know?" he asked, his voice flirty. The British accent was the same, but the rhythm of speech was wrong, and there were no swear words for me to edit out. "Was Wolf actually naked?" I asked. "Wolves are usually naked," he said as if he were joking. "For sure," I agreed easily. Upstairs, a soft shushing of a window sliding up. I knew it was Jesse's window. But if someone wasn't familiar with the sounds of the house, maybe it would just blend into the various creaks and groans that were the normal sounds of any house. I didn't know if Ben would know what that sound meant. I didn't know how much of Ben's memories the beast who had bitten him would have. Jesse's window was accessible from the porch roof, which was a security concern, but it was also an escape path if something bad was happening in the house. Adam had decided that risk and benefit balanced out. I listened, but no further noise emerged from upstairs. Either Adam had managed not to wake Jesse up, or she had realized that there was something going on. Ben held out the spoon to me again. I scooped up more dough and held it out. But this time, he grabbed my wrist. "I have a secret," he said. He wasn't hurting me. I let my wrist lie limp in his grip. "What's that?" I asked. "I let you see the marks," he told me. "I even made sure to mark this body when I was wearing the rabbit so that you would know what you were looking at." "Why did you do that?" I asked. Was there a squeak on the stairs? I took a deep breath and smelled the smoke beast's magic. It filled my lungs, and I couldn't smell anything else over it. "I wanted to see what you would do," he said. "Why can't I take you? I can kill you. I almost did the other night. But I am supposed to be able to take any but the most powerful of the lords of the Fae. You are not Fae at all. What are you?" "Chaos," I told him. His eyebrows furrowed and his eyes narrowed with the beginnings of anger. He would have said something more, but quick footsteps came up from the basement, and Aiden bounded into the kitchen. The beast's magic surged. Visions of that semi-tractor melded with the concrete of the Pasco Tunnel's safety rail danced in my head. I didn't know that he could do that to a living being. Life affects magic. We might be just carbon compounds, but there was something about the state of living that was magical. But if the beast was amassing magic at the sight of Aiden, I wasn't willing to wait to see what it could do. While he was distracted by Aiden, I twisted my wrist, grabbed his wrist with mine, and swiveled my hips to pull him off balance. At the same time, I kicked his knee as hard as I could. He grunted as his knee popped audibly, and he released me involuntarily, and I let go and jumped back. There were a number of counters to that move. Ben knew them, but the creature controlling his body made no effort to use any defense. My attack had been quick and instinctive, and it had taken the beast by surprise. Impossible to say how much of Ben's knowledge the beast had access to. Earlier, he hadn't known the difference between wolf and a wolf, but with the evidence I had, I couldn't assume that he couldn't fight as well as Ben. I also didn't know if he would feel pain occupying Ben's body, but it didn't matter much at that moment. The damage to Ben's knee was a physical thing that slowed his body down. I grabbed for a weapon and came up with my marble rolling pin, but by the time I turned to face Ben again, Adam was there. I hadn't heard him. I missed the first move, just heard the noise as Ben's shoulder broke from a joint lock. As Ben fell, pushed by Adam's hold, Adam brought his knee over and landed on the small of Ben's back. I heard those bones crack too.
"It won't hold him long," said Adam,
but I was already running. I jumped over them both and ran down the stairs to the cage that would be our safe room once construction wrapped it in more civilized trappings. But the cage itself was finished, and the silver cuffs and chains were hanging from a hook on a post just outside it. I dropped the rolling pin, cracking it on the exposed concrete floor. I would feel bad about that later, because it had belonged to my mother's mother.
But at the moment, I was too busy grabbing the cuffs and chains. Beast or not, the creature was wearing Ben's body, and these bindings would hold a werewolf. I ran back up the stairs to find the tableau unchanged. Ben writhed and jerked under Adam, seemingly unbothered by the pain of the broken bones, though his lower extremities were unmoving. Adam kept him down. About 10 feet from them, fitful fire wreathing his hands, Aiden watched them with wary eyes. I bound Ben's legs together, then closed one of the cuffs on the wrist connected to his broken shoulder. Adam took over from there. Without consideration of the pain of Ben's broken bones, he pulled Ben's arms behind his back and cuffed his wrists tightly together. Then Adam connected the leg manacles until Ben was effectively hogtied with steel and silver, his skin blackening where the metal touched him. As soon as he was held immobile, Ben's body went limp.
"God, oh God," he whispered. "Don't let me go. He's still in my head. He wants her dead. She scares him and he wants me to kill her. No more fucking around asking questions. Just kill her. Find out why later."
Ben took a deep, shuddering breath.
"Don't let me go."
"Okay,"
Adam said.
"Don't let Mercy anywhere near me," he said. "Oh God, he's in my head and I can't.
He went limp again. "Is he breathing?" I asked, panicked.
"This is my fault, Adam. I sent him out there."
"He's breathing," Adam said. "Pulse is strong. Takes more than a few broken bones and an uncanny thing's possession to kill a werewolf."
He looked at me.
"He was on guard duty, in harm's way. That was his job tonight."
I wrapped my arms around myself. "I sent him out to talk to Wolf," I told Adam. "I forgot about the smoke beast."
"It didn't forget about us," said Adam.
Running water didn't help Ben. Warren and Kyle showed up about 10 minutes before Daryl because they'd been working at Kyle's office. Ben's bones had mended themselves by that time, and he was half sitting, half lying on the fainting couch in the living room. Adam had put him there after deciding he didn't want to try to get him down the stairs and into the cage by himself for fear of having to hurt Ben further. Werewolves healed fast, but even Adam, drawing on the power of the pack, would have had a hard time healing the kind of damage Ben had suffered in the half hour or so that had elapsed. I couldn't smell the beast's magic anymore, but I didn't make the mistake of thinking it was gone. Ben's periodic bouts of madness would have disabused me of that if I'd trusted my nose too much. I already knew that sometimes I couldn't detect this magic.
"Well," Warren told Ben in a squeaky voice that was an obvious attempt to imitate someone, "here's another nice mess you've gotten you into."
"I suppose by that, I'm to assume I'm Laurel?" asked Ben, trying to sound like himself, but his voice was tight and there was a rough growl on the edges.
"You aren't Hardy," said Adam.
I hadn't made the connection. Laurel and Hardy were well before my time, before Ben's time too, as he was actually about my age. Adam, on the other hand, had a whole 4 decades more of cultural references than I did. It had never mattered to me before this moment. I was discouraged to discover that I could be terrified for Ben and still worried about the distance between Adam and me. Warren glanced at me and then at Adam, so apparently I didn't hide what I was feeling well enough. Adam said,
"We are just waiting on Daryl."
Warren shook his head.
"He's not that heavy. You and I can carry him down to the river."
"It's not the carrying me that's the problem," said Ben, his voice shaky. "Anytime anyone comes within spitting distance, I turn into that girl from The Exorcist."
"Your head doesn't spin around," I said, trying not to sound as scared as I was.
"Don't give it any helpful fucking ideas," Ben scolded me.
He'd bounced around between calling the creature who controlled him by the masculine pronoun and by it. I was withholding judgment. Daryl arrived eventually.
"Sorry, flat tire."
"No worries," said Ben. "Just sitting here possessed by an evil fae."
The minute they touched him, Ben started to struggle. Undeterred, the three werewolves dragged Ben kicking and screaming out to the river. I followed them, feeling sick.
Kyle walked next to me, his hand on my shoulder. I almost didn't flinch when another hand landed on my other shoulder, and Wolf, wrapped toga-style in the fuzzy red blanket, took up the space on my right.
"Nasty business," said Wolf conversationally.
"Yes," I agreed. There was no way to signal to Kyle to back away, and I knew him well enough to know that he wouldn't, even if I could ask him. I would just have to keep Wolf's attention on me and off the vulnerable human on my other side. Kyle helpfully kept silent. Warren caught sight of Wolf and got Ben's bound feet in his stomach for his troubles. He was forced to pay attention to what he was doing.
"Interesting to see if the river works," Wolf continued.
"You don't think it will?" I asked. He pursed his lips, looking, in his toga, like an escapee from a frat party gone wrong. I knew he was older than Stefan, who had been made a vampire early in the Renaissance era, but he would never grow up to look like an adult. His feet were bare, but the rocks and tackweed didn't seem to bother him.
"Should work," he said at last. "I don't know why it would work for you, but not for your little red riding wolf."
Ben's wolf was red. I didn't like that Wolf knew that. Wolf tilted his head to watch the struggling wolves just ahead of us.
"But I have an odd feeling that it won't," he said in casual tones. "Shame. It was nice of him to bring me a blanket, don't you think? Though that might have been your idea. I forget what he said."
His hand tightened on my neck. When had he moved his hand to my neck? I must have made some sound, because Adam glanced over at me and asked if I needed help with a single look. I shook my head briefly. He needed to pay attention to Ben. I didn't know if Ben could spread his contagion with a bite, but I'd feel better if no one had to worry about it. Besides, I was fairly certain that Wolf wasn't ready to quit playing at whatever game he'd decided upon yet, so I should be safe enough. I wish Stefan would call me back. It wasn't like him to not return my calls.
"I'm not supposed to be here, you know," said Wolf.
"Oh?" I asked.
"Marsilia has called all the vampires to the Seethe because..."
"Oh, that's why." I tried to make his words make sense, then realized he'd been talking to himself for the last bit.
"That's why what?" "That's why I don't think running water will help your wolf. It didn't help Stefan."
I stopped. "Stefan?"
"We tried to dump him in the river," Wolf said obligingly. "But all that accomplished was getting a whole bunch of us wet. Good thing we don't need to breathe, or several members of the Seethe would have drowned. He took one out anyway, but I didn't like her, so I'm not sorry."
I thought of all those phone calls I'd made. I struggled to imagine Stefan caught up by the smoke beast and failed. Stefan was reserved, controlled. I had a sudden memory of him in a rage, his face contorted. But even then, Stefan had never moved, even when the demon killed a hotel maid in front of him and used demonic powers to inspire visceral bloodlust in my friend. There was no dignity in Ben's desperate struggles. I didn't want to imagine Stefan in the same condition.
"What else have you tried?" I asked, starting toward the river again. There was nothing I could do for Stefan right this moment.
Wolf shrugged.
"The usual, after the river, salt, silver, torture, fire. Nothing seems to work."
"Do you know how to kill it? Or if killing it will save Ben and Stefan?" I asked, fighting not to visualize someone torturing Stefan. Wolf was old, Middle Ages old, and he was a sorcerer, a witch, and a vampire. He should know something about this beast.
"I meant to ask you what you knew about it," he responded, as if we were walking to tea instead of watching Adam, Warren, and Daryl struggle to hold on to the bound form of Ben long enough to get to the water's edge.
I told him everything I knew. It didn't take long.
"Smoke beast," said Wolf as Ben arced out over the water and entered with a splash. "Never heard of it. Smoking bites don't ring any bells either, and I know a lot about things that bite."
He snapped his teeth together. Kyle let me go, and I broke free of Wolf so I could get a better look at Adam, Warren, and Daryl trying to drag Ben out of the water. He seemed to be trying to slip out of their fingers. And werewolves don't float. They sink. Too much muscle, not enough fat. Or maybe it was something about the way their magic worked. All four of them were wet by the time they dragged Ben back to shore. He choked up water in great heaving coughs that strained his bound limbs. The river had almost succeeded in drowning him. When Adam reached for the cuffs, Ben shook his head. "No!" And after he spoke that single word, he coughed up another burst of river, only to collapse in a limp heap.
"He's in me," he said.
Then tears leaked out as if he'd absorbed some of the river into his eyes as well as his lungs.
"He's still here. Don't let me free."
"Shh," said Adam.
He looked at me. "Did you hear Wolf?" I asked. He nodded, then kissed the top of Ben's head, avoiding the snap of Ben's teeth without apparent effort.
"We have a problem. Let's get him back to the cage where I can at least get him out of the cuffs. I'll call Marsilia and check on Stefan."
"That would work better," I acknowledged silently. She liked Adam, and she really didn't like me. Especially, she wouldn't like me asking about Stefan. She tended to view him as her property, and viewed me as the reason he'd broken free of the seethe. He was the only vampire in the Tri-Cities who did not belong to her. We could work together when we had to, but there was no reason to push it now. And all of that gave me something to think about, other than our poor Ben and Stefan caught up in the same hell, and I had nothing I could do to help.
"Where did the scary vampire go?" asked Kyle in a low voice.
"Wherever scary vampires go," answered Warren.
His voice acquired a hard edge.
"Don't worry, he'll be back."
We settled Ben in the cage with a mattress on the floor and the chains and cuffs off. Releasing him from the cuffs had almost resulted in disaster. If Kyle hadn't been carrying a stun gun and been unafraid to use it, Ben would have broken free. Adam called Marsilia, and she confirmed what Wolf had told us. The beast had indeed gotten Stefan, though when asked, she said the bite marks on his shoulder were more akin to a big snake, a very big snake, than to a rabbit. She sent photos. Two red marks the size of a dime marred the white flesh of his left shoulder. According to the measuring tape, the marks were 4¾ inches apart.
"That's the size of a horse's mouth," Warren said, "more or less."
"Does he know what bit him?" Adam asked.
"He has not been able to share coherent information with us," said Marsilia. "We can keep him indefinitely, I suppose. But I would not keep anyone I cared about in this state for long."
"No,"
agreed Adam, watching Ben, who stared back at him with eyes that were not Ben's.
"But we are working on it."
"Except for Wolf, with whom it is not practical, I have brought all of my people and their flocks to our sea, then locked us in," Marsilia said. "I understand that you think that you need to do something about this, but I advise you to do the same. Think about what the news organizations will do when one of your wolves is bitten and goes on a killing spree."
"Is that what Stefan did?" I asked. Then I had a panicked thought. "What about his people?"
"Vampire hearing was good too," she said. "All of his sheep are safe."
I did not add those who survived, but I wanted to. Marsilia had killed some of Stefan's people, he had never in my hearing referred to them as sheep or his flock, in order to perpetrate some desperate scheme or other. He had never forgiven her. She blamed me. Not for her having to kill his people, but for his lack of forgiveness. It didn't make sense, but emotions don't have to make sense.
"How did you discover what had happened?" Adam asked.
"A wolf brought him in," she said. "It was not pretty, and there was no doubt that something or someone else was controlling him. He did not try to blend in at all."
"Thank you for the information," Adam said. "If we find out anything useful, I'll make sure you get word."
"I would appreciate that,"
Marsilia told him. Warren and Kyle left to go home and sleep. Daryl settled in as our guard since Ben had been retired from the field. Adam and Daryl were still discussing how to patrol safely when I went up to bed. I was pretty sure that Adam wouldn't come up to bed until I was safely asleep, so I left them talking and went upstairs. I paused in front of Jesse's door, then gave in to my need to see someone safe tonight and cracked the door. She was curled up on the bed with a stuffed elephant that I knew Gabriel had gotten her. I shut the door again and left her to her dreams. I was just pulling the bedding up to my chin when my phone rang. Caller ID said the number was unavailable. I hesitated, but it was the wrong time of night for a robocall.
"Mercedes," said Beauclair, son of Luch and Grey Lord of the Fae. "Uncle Mike asked me to call you tonight. A few days ago, he informed me that Underhill created a door to her realm in your backyard, and in the process, she released a predator, one that Aiden told you was called the Smoke Beast."
"Yes," I told him.
"I know of that one," Beauclair told me, and I felt a shiver of relief.
Beauclair knew things about the creature who held Ben and Stefan. He would know what to do about it so we could save Ben and save Stefan.
"You know that Marsilia has locked down her seed because Stefan was taken?"
"Yes," I said.
"Did you hear about the accident on Highway 240? The terrible, tragic accident where a tanker sideswiped two other cars? All three drivers and their passengers died. 8 people in all."
That accident had happened the same night that Kyle had shot one of the werewolves. It had made the front page and relegated Kyle and Warren's encounter to the public records section of the newspaper. "Yes," I said, sick to my stomach, because Marsilia was fond of using car wrecks or house fires to account for problem bodies that needed to be explained. She had told me that Stefan's people were safe, but she had not answered my first question about a killing spree, and I hadn't noticed until just now.
"A few hours ago, one of the Fae, not a Grey Lord, but one who had power and skill, walked into Uncle Mike's with a sword and used it and her magic to kill as many as she could. 14 Fae died, and also 3 humans and 2 goblins. Uncle Mike was on other business, so he was not present. Had Larry the Goblin King and the Snow Elf not been there, more people would have died."
There was no such thing, as far as I knew, as a Snow Elf. It was just what our resident frost giant liked to be called. I thought about how powerful a fae had to be if it took both the Goblin King and a frost giant to subdue.
"Some of those who died were very old and very powerful beings," Beauclair told me. "Uncle Mike says that your previous encounters with the Smoke Beast seemed to indicate that it was having difficulty acquiring power. I thought you should be warned that, as of tonight, that is no longer the case."
"I see," I said. I no longer was hopeful that Beauclair was going to provide me with an easy way to save my friends.
"Because of tonight's incident, and because of the problems the vampires have experienced, I have called all the Fae in the area back to the reservation, including Zebolt Adalbert Schmeiter and his son."
There was a bite to Z's full name.
Z had killed Beauclair's father a zillion years ago, but the Fae have long memories.
"Is there anything that you can tell me that would help us defeat it?" I asked.
"Yes."
A pause, as if Beauclair was being careful with his words, more careful than usual.
"I cannot tell you who he is."
And that was important, or it wouldn't have been the first thing he said in answer to my question.
"Cannot," I said, as opposed to "will not."
"Like a Gaius?"
"To you, perhaps that is the best way to explain it. It is a quirk of his nature. I can tell you a few, very few things about him."
"Please," I said, tightening my grip on the phone.
"In addition to Smoke Beast, some call him Smoke Weaver or Smoke Dragon, all 3 referring to his nature. None of them are his name or bear any resemblance to his name."
"Because you cannot speak his name," I said, to tell him that I caught the import of what he was telling me.
"That is so," he said. Long ago, he was captured by Underhill, a result of a bargain he made with her. He needed to bargain, as a part of the nature of the creature he was. A human woman gained the upper hand that somehow triggered the terms of his bargain with Underhill. Underhill swallowed him, and I had thought him safely caught up in her nets for all these years.
Needed, I said, as in no longer needs.
He didn't answer me right away. Any answer I make to you may be misleading, he said.
We think Underhill let him out on purpose, I told him.
Do you? He asked, but more as if he found the idea interesting. To what purpose, I wonder? And why at the door in your backyard instead of in one of those in the reservation where his prey would be so much more interesting, where he could cause so much more death?
And become so much more powerful, I half asked, half stated. Then I had a worrying realization.
As he did tonight at Uncle Mike's?
I am speculating now, Beauclair said in apology, or as close to an apology as a Grey Lord was comfortable giving. It was a matter of tone rather than words.
I do not know why Underhill does what she does, but it is interesting that the first thing that happened when she put a door in your yard was that the smoke beast escaped.
Do you know what he wants? What his goal is? I asked. He seems to be sticking around here.
I don't know what he wants, said Beauclair, and again there was an apology in his tone. I myself never met him personally, but he can take any of the Fae.
He said he couldn't, I interrupted him, to me. He's taken one of our wolves. He said he could take all but the most powerful of the Fae lords.
Interesting, said Beauclair, but we cannot risk it. The one he took tonight was powerful. Our gates are closed indefinitely.
How do I save them, I asked, my friends who he has taken?
I don't know, he said. And he was Fae, so it had to be true. But I will ask if any do. Should I gain that knowledge, I will see that you are told.
How many can he take and hold at a time, I asked.
I don't know that either. Likely that depends upon the power he amasses.
In other words, more people now than he could have controlled before tonight.
How do I kill him? I asked.
I don't know that either, he answered. No one has managed to do so yet. I do know that he can only be harmed in his own form, whatever shape he wears, not in the bodies of those he takes. That his own form shifts to smoke as he wills, so he cannot be easily imprisoned. Underhill managed. You might speak to her.
He paused.
There is a story about him. And it has to do with bargains.
He stopped again.
My incomplete knowledge of the smoke weaver and creatures of his ilk makes me leery of telling you more than this.
His voice changed, deepened, and developed an odd resonance. It sounded more feminine, and that voice was familiar.
The key to his undoing is in his basic nature. Do not pay attention to smoke and appearances.
Baba Yaga? I asked.
Beauclair sighed. She will have her games, he said, but her advice is good.
He disconnected. I set my phone on the bedside table and then realized that Adam was standing in the doorway. I didn't know how long he'd been there. There was something alien in his eyes that reminded me of the night we'd had the fight over Jesse's school. How much of that did you hear? I asked cautiously.
I came up when the phone rang, he said. I wonder why Beauclair called you instead of me.
There was an edge of anger in his voice.
Probably, I decided, that was because Ben was locked up in a cage possessed by an escapee from Underhill, and we couldn't do anything about it.
I don't know, I said, and that was true. He could have called Adam. I wondered if Beauclair's calling me instead was a message, too. The Fae could be very subtle creatures.
Adam's jaw tightened at my reply, but he didn't say anything. He just shut the door and went back downstairs. I waited for him for a while, but it was nearing 1 a.m, and I was going to have to get up early to post a closed until further notice sign on my business and call everyone who had an appointment at the shop. Without Tad or Z, the shop made me a target.
not just for invading werewolves or escaped prisoners of Underhill, but also any crackpot, supernatural or not, who wanted to launch an attack on our pack. Most people, even most preternatural people, thought I was a mundane human. That I could turn into a coyote was pretty cool, but it didn't make me a superhero. I set my alarm, pulled the covers over my head, and closed my eyes, but I didn't really go to sleep until I felt the mattress sink under Adam's weight. For whatever reason, he hadn't gone to the spare room to sleep tonight, and I was grateful. I woke up face down on my pillow with the urgent feeling that I was under threat. I could feel eyes on me, feel the hunt engaged with me as its target. I lay very still and breathed shallowly through my mouth. Was it Wolf? I couldn't smell anyone but Adam and me in the room. Adam moved on the bed, and the feeling gradually faded. Probably it was the leftover of a very bad dream. I rolled until I could touch Adam, and my fingers slid through his fur. I was pretty sure that he'd been in his human form when he'd come to bed, but I'd been mostly asleep, so I could have been wrong. I buried my face in the fur at his neck, and the scent and feel of him brushed away the last of that paranoid feeling that had awoken me. I was very tired, so it didn't take long to start drifting back to sleep. "Good night," I murmured.
"Sleep," the wolf told me through our bond. "The threat is over for tonight."
Chapter 8. Adam was gone when my alarm woke me up. Downstairs, Daryl had been replaced by George, who was taking his coffee down to keep watch over Ben. "How is he?" I asked.
"Not good," said George, pausing halfway to the basement. "He's himself this morning, but he says that thing still has a hold on him."
He hesitated.
"He doesn't want you down there. He says that thing in his head wants to kill you in the worst way."
I didn't know what to say to that. The urge to go down and watch over him was a pain in my heart. He was my friend, and in trouble that he'd gotten into following my wishes. But if the thing was leaving him alone, more or less, as long as I was out of reach, I wasn't going to make matters worse for him. The image of him crying on the bank of the river last night was a strong one. I didn't have any comment on Ben's situation that I wished to share out loud, so I said, "Beauclair called me last night." I needed a sounding board, but Adam had obviously not wanted to talk to me about the call. Who better to talk to than George, who solved crimes for a living?
"So I heard," George said. "Adam talked to Daryl. Daryl told me."
He frowned at me, then said,
"Daryl said Beauclair didn't have much to say."
He glanced downstairs and then started walking toward Adam's office.
"But both Adam and Daryl indicated that all important conversations should happen in the upstairs bedrooms with the doors shut, or in Adam's office."
So Ben wouldn't overhear us. George took the fancy chair. I closed the office door and took my usual seat on Adam's desk. "Did Adam and Daryl have their conversation in here or out there?" I asked.
"In here," George said, his eyes shrewd.
I felt sick. Beauclair had been subtle, but Adam understood subtle better than I did. Reading between the lines was admittedly dangerous with the Fae. But Beauclair did not want to keep his people locked up in the reservation. Without Underhill being a safe refuge for the Fae, which she decidedly was not, the reservation was a limited-time solution. If all the Fae remained trapped inside those walls, they would start feeding upon each other, in both a figurative and literal sense. Beauclair had already proven that his primary goal was the survival of his people, and his people were all of the Fae. Beauclair had been subtle, for sure, but he'd given me a lot of information. That Adam hadn't seen it scared me. Beauclair thinks that there is a reason Underhill let the smoke beast escape in our yard instead of the reservation, where it could have had access to Fae who could kill hundreds, if not thousands, of people in very short order. And that last was why Beauclair had pulled all of his people to safety. It was also why Marsilia had sealed her people in, too.
"So she didn't want to create chaos or kill lots of Fae," said George.
"Right," I agreed.
When Aiden discovered the door, Underhill told him, "I need a door to Mercy's backyard. I miss you. The Fae aren't playing nice." I frowned, trying to remember exactly what Aiden had told me. There had been something about not wanting to owe the Fae anything. But George said,
"She meant those statements to be put together."
He'd seen what I had.
That she wanted a door to your backyard so she could see Aiden because she didn't trust the Fae with him, or they were using his visits as bargaining chips or some such thing.
I nodded. But why would she need to let him go in my backyard? She likes Adam better than me. She could have said Adam's backyard. And Aiden lives here, so she could have said your backyard.
The smoke beast bit you, George said, and it couldn't control you.
Okay, I said. I think that is significant. And later she told Aiden something about me being good at killing monsters. I grabbed a small spiral notebook out of Adam's top drawer, ruthlessly ripped out all the pages with writing on them, and shoved them back in the drawer. Then I wrote, "Underhill released Smoke Beast here because of me. Smoke Beast's bite doesn't let him control me."
"It still almost killed you," he reminded me.
"Why didn't it just turn me into concrete like it did that semi?" I asked him. "Or for that matter, why didn't it just turn you and me both into concrete?"
"Because we're living," George postulated.
I shook my head. "Z says that for Fae magic, transformation is transformation."
"Power," suggested George.
That was what Z had concluded as well.
"She said that she killed things for power, and she hadn't been able to kill those kids crossing the road. Maybe she used all her power transforming the semi, and that's why the whole semi wasn't concrete when we got there. I've been wondering why, when she was mad at the driver, she only transformed part of the semi. What if she was trying to transform the whole thing, driver and all, but didn't have the juice to do it? She took Dennis, and Dennis killed Anna, but didn't kill anyone else. You didn't kill anyone or die yourself. She took this poor hitchhiker and still didn't manage to kill anyone that we know of. That's a lot of power outlay."
"That sounds right," I said, writing, "Did not have enough power to transform George and me and only half semi."
"So if we can keep the people the beast takes from killing anyone, we can keep it powered down," George said. "We have been contained."
He sounded so hopeful. "Did Adam tell Daryl and Daryl tell you that one of the Fae was bitten, went into Uncle Mike's and killed a whole bunch of people, Fae and human and goblin? That Larry and the Frost Giant stopped it?" George frowned.
"No," he said, "just that the Fae, like the vampires, are holed up until the smoke beast is dealt with. By us."
"Do you remember the big car wreck that pushed Kyle's discharging of a firearm to protect Warren off the front page?" I asked. George looked sick.
"Stefan," he said.
I nodded. "That's what Beauclair indicated. I think that the smoke beast has plenty of power right now."
"What else did Beauclair tell you?" George asked.
"He said that they called it the smoke dragon and smoke weaver, that both of those terms spoke to its nature, that it had a name, but Beauclair could not speak it, nor could any Fae, and that that was because of the rules under which the smoke weaver operated." George started to say something, but I held up a hand. "Sorry, there is something Z told me. He said that what the smoke beast," I hesitated, because Beauclair had told me what they called the creature for a reason. "What the smoke weaver is doing with the whole body snatching and killing to power up is more like the way an artifact would have been made. He said that the transformations like what the weaver did with the semi are a power that belonged to a group of lesser fae."
"Huh," said George. "That would explain the power problem it has. I have never noticed that the fae have trouble powering their own magic. Maybe it has an artifact it's using? All you have to do is figure out what it is and take it away."
That sounded like an interesting plan. I wish I had the book Ariana, a powerful fae I knew, had written about her people. It had a whole section on artifacts, but I didn't remember any of them operating quite like that. If Z had known of one or built one, he would have told me. The book was gone, but I would call Ariana and see if she knew of something like this. Last I had heard from her, she was somewhere in Africa with her mate Samuel, and communication was tricky. George had moved on.
"Are we sure this is Fae?
You said her magic, its magic, didn't smell fey.
I shrugged. I haven't run into it before. There are a lot of fey. Maybe this one is like the platypus, or the goblins for that matter. It doesn't quite fit in.
What else did Beauclair say? Asked George, half closing his eyes, which was what he did when he was thinking hard.
That we're unlikely to be able to kill it, and Beauclair hadn't mentioned an artifact, and that trick it has of transforming itself to smoke makes it hard to capture. He then said that Underhill had imprisoned it because of a bargain it made, and that there is a story about that bargain I should find. Then Baba Yaga shut him up and told me that the key to the smoke weaver's undoing is to be found in his basic nature.
Huh.
His basic nature, I said again.
So we have a start, said George. That's more than we knew when Ben got bitten. I have a few contacts that might know something about artifacts. Even if they're locked up in fairyland, cell phones still work. I'll do some sleuthing.
I'd appreciate that. I hopped off the desk and opened the door. I need to go put some signs up at my garage, I told George. I'm trusting you to keep Ben from killing anyone, or himself, while I'm gone.
He doesn't seem suicidal, George said. He ate a hearty breakfast, muffin with bacon, eggs, and cheese, all off a paper plate without even so much as a fork or spoon. He's not exactly cheery, but Ben isn't usually a cheery sort of guy.
Ben was usually pretty cheery around me. Foul-mouthed and sarcastic, maybe, but cheerful enough. For sure, he hadn't started out that way. Maybe he was grumpier around other people, or they avoided him so much that they didn't know he'd changed.
So you played cook this morning? I asked.
George didn't strike me as the homemaker type. Toast and eggs, maybe, but not a better-than version of a fast food staple.
Adam cooked it up for all of us. George frowned at me. He was cooking when I got here at 5, and Daryl said you didn't get to sleep until the wee hours. You look like you could use another 8 hours to sleep. You both need to get more rest or you aren't going to be any good for anything.
News at 11, I said dryly, and he grinned.
Telling you things you already know is the job of all your friends, he said, and headed down to the basement.
When had George become my friend? I had a smile on my face when I opened the fridge, but it dropped away when I saw the deconstructed breakfast sandwich on the large plate with assembly instructions written out in Adam's handwriting. The sandwich was for me, and another time I would have taken it as a thoughtful love note kind of thing. But we weren't in that place right now, so that limited the reasons for this gesture. Apologies or guilt, which were both kind of the same thing. I thought just then of waking up in the middle of the night knowing there was a predator watching me with hostile eyes, of reaching out and finding Adam in wolf form.
I don't trust myself, he'd said. I've been a werewolf for longer than you've been alive, and it's been decades since I've had trouble with it. But now I wake up and I'm in my wolf shape without remembering how I got there.
Could that hostile presence have been Adam? Shaken, I microwaved the things that needed to be microwaved and toasted the English muffin. Adam had said he didn't know what had caused his problem controlling his shape-shifting, but his wolf had blamed the witches. Adam was smart, but beyond that, he was perceptive. He didn't usually have blinders on when he was looking at people, even if he was looking into a mirror. I bit into the sandwich. He was, in fact, overly harsh when looking into a mirror. He still thought he was a monster. I swallowed and considered that. Could it be that the witches had done something to him and he thought it was his own inner demons breaking free? That the wolf was right and Adam was wrong? And what the freak could I do about that? Find another witch? I thought of Elisaveta, who had been our Pax witch for decades before Adam had had to kill her. I didn't know that there was a witch I would trust Adam to. Maybe I should talk to Bran. That was an idea with some merit. I finished the sandwich and punished myself with a glass of orange juice for health. Followed that up by punishing myself with a cup of coffee to stay awake for the day. Coffee I found nearly as vile as orange juice, but hopefully both of them would do their jobs. I was dumping the last half of my coffee in the sink
when the front door opened, and my nose told me that Aurelie had walked in.
"We are both being chastised," she told me as she walked into the kitchen. "I am to accompany you on whatever you are doing today."
Her tone was neutral, as was her body language. I had no idea what she was feeling about doing guard duty for me. Maybe it was time to put the cards on the table. I dusted my hands off and gave her a somber look. "I like you. I think that you are too easily led by your need to protect Christy, who needs protecting about as much as a jaguar needs protecting." I didn't call Christy either a shark or a viper. Go me. Aurelie gave me a look that told me that she'd heard viper instead of the sexier jaguar just fine.
"I like you," she told me without sounding like she was going to choke on it. "You are a goody two-shoes sometimes, but you'd fall on a grenade for Adam or Jesse or a member of the pack. You fell on a grenade for Christy even, but you would also fall on a grenade for a total stranger. And that makes you a liability to the pack." I thought about what she said.
"That's fair," I told her, "but I don't open other people's mail."
"That's fair too," she said. "Where are we going and when? Adam said he thought you'd be moving by 8.
It was 7, and if she'd been 5 minutes later, I'd have been gone. Normally, I'd have been headed to church, although not at 7 a.m., but the garage was more urgent today. I grabbed my purse and said, "The garage. The Fae have recalled everyone into the reservation. Without Z and Tad there, under the circumstances, working in the garage by myself is a liability to the pack." I deliberately chose her words. She nodded approvingly.
"Good decision,"
implying that most of my decisions were not. But I was a grown-up and didn't bring up her decision to open Jesse's mail again. I used the shop computer and printed out signs after Aurelie observed that my handwritten signs looked like something her students would do if they were trying to flunk her class. I am not a computer whiz and wasn't sure the ones I'd put together were any better than the handwritten ones, but I put them up anyway while Aurelie played on her phone. And I hid the signs I'd previously scrawled with a marker for everyday use. "Lunch break, back in 5, and unexpected drama will return eventually." On that sign, I had initially spelled eventually with one L. In my defense, I'd been in a panic when I'd written it. Tad later corrected it for me using a different color marker than I'd used. It probably said something about me that it didn't bother me to display it for my clients, but I didn't want Aurelie to see it. I called and canceled the appointments for that week that I could and streamlined the rest. I'd come in on Monday and fix a few desperately needed vehicles. I sent some of my clients with newer cars to the dealership, and a few who couldn't afford the dealership to another garage. 50-50 chance that those clients would stay with that garage afterward because he was good and nearly as inexpensive as I was.
"I thought you were closing the garage until further notice," Aurelie said as I locked up.
"That's right.
But you are still coming back Monday," she said.
"There are some cars I can't trust to anyone else," I said, "and a few customers who need special handling. I'll get one of the wolves to come in with me. People need their cars to work." We got back in my Jetta.
"We could have taken my car," she said, not for the first time.
"I don't want to get oil stains on any car that Daryl half owns," I told her seriously. "He might have a heart attack, and we can't afford to lose any more wolves until Adam succeeds in bringing the invaders into our fold." She laughed.
"Ah, so it is not the gas mileage or the need to be in the driver's seat."
Which were the answers that I'd given her the first two times she'd complained about the Jetta.
"It is out of a deep and abiding concern for my husband's health."
"Absolutely," I said. "I like Daryl." "We aren't going back?" she asked as I turned the wrong way to head home. "Nope," I said. "It's been a rough few days. I'm going for donuts. Spud nuts." Spud nuts were called spud nuts because the dough was made from potato flour. Ben loved spud nuts.
"Okay," she said. "I could do a donut."
Spud nuts was in the uptown in Richland, a fair commute from my garage in East Kennewick, but it was totally worth the trip. Except when it was closed, which apparently it was. "Well, that's sad," I said.
Why did I not know it was closed on Sundays? I was sure I'd come here on Sunday once or twice.
Safeway has good donuts, Aurieli offered soberly.
I sighed. Grocery store donuts and spud nuts shouldn't be mentioned in the same breath. With the garage closed for the foreseeable future, it looked like I was going to have some extra time on my hands. Maybe I should try making donuts. My homemade bread was good. I already knew how to make fry bread, and there wasn't a whole lot of... My brain lit up with information. I didn't know if the other wolves saw their connections to the pack the way I did. To me, it was like a web of Christmas garland, sparkly and metallic with unexpected lights here and there. The mating bond between Adam and me, a thick, glowing rope. That one changed every time I observed. Today it was a sullen red with orange light moving within, almost like a lava lamp. The orange light, I was sure, was information the bond wanted me to have, but Adam was keeping from me. Under normal circumstances, that bond informed me of things like Adam's mood, where he was, what music he was listening to, or what he was thinking about. The pack bonds, on the other hand, very seldom told me much. Mostly, I could tell when someone died. I knew that Adam got a lot more information than that. But the only time the pack bonds really gave me much was when we were on a hunt. Then it was overwhelming, as if the whole pack was one beast. I would have thought I'd freak out when I was consumed by the pack bonds, but it was the best feeling in the world. There was no sadness, no worry, nothing except for a wild joy that seared my nerve endings. No hesitation, no questioning, just knowing that the pack is one. Granted, if the bonds had done that all the time, turning us into a hive mind like the Borg from Star Trek, I'd be moving to Istanbul or Outer Mongolia or some other faraway place to get away. But once or twice a month in a planned and organized hunt, that was pretty cool. Today was different. I froze where I was, standing in the parking lot with my hand on the top of the open door of my disreputable Jetta, my head and fingertips buzzing with the urgency of the call. The power of it made the air I breathed feel electric. And as on the nights of the hunt, I knew things I had no business knowing. I knew that Kelly was down and scared and...
Micaiah, said Aurieli, putting her butt in the passenger seat of the Jetta.
I'd gotten that, too. Micaiah was Kelly's 6-year-old daughter, and she was in trouble. We were less than 2 miles from Kelly's house. I was peeling rubber before Aurieli slammed her door shut. On the whole, 80s Jettas look like pedestrian cars, something built along the lines of the Chevette or Echo. Useful, but unpretty and unremarkable. My Jetta, midway through restorations, was remarkable for all the wrong reasons. But unlike my beloved Vanagon, which was lucky to attain highway speed, the Jetta was built to move, not only quick, but also maneuverable. I was doing 60 when I took the corner from Jadwin onto Kelly Street, and the wheels stayed on the ground when I did it. Ahead, right by Kelly's house, I could see a large man with a small child in his hands. He was holding her above his head. Just beyond them was a large construction dumpster.
She's alive, said Aurieli, her voice raspy with wolf. She's moving her legs.
If I hit him with the car, I asked her, can you make the grab from the hood of the car to protect her? I braked pretty hard as I spoke, slowing the car until we were going about 25 miles an hour. Much faster, and Aurieli wouldn't have a chance. Much slower, and I risked not doing enough damage to the werewolf to get him to drop Micaiah. This was an old car, well designed, but what I was planning was going to hurt me, too, because it didn't have airbags. That thought was a rueful one, and didn't change my plans. Micaiah was a child, and also a smart aleck, and I adored her. Aurieli didn't bother to answer me. She just broke out the side window with one definite hit of her elbow and climbed out over the shattered glass. The Jetta's windows rolled up and down manually. She'd still have been lowering the glass 10 seconds after we passed Kelly's house if she'd tried it that way. Being a werewolf gave her the strength to break the window efficiently and crawl outside without risk of falling on the ground.
but it was her own natural grace that let her stand on the hood of the Jetta while I drove over a pothole-pocked road, aiming my 2,000-pound weapon at the bad guy holding the little girl. He dropped Micaiah, holding her by one leg. Apparently his intent was to scare her family, because his focus was toward Kelly's house. I couldn't see Kelly or his mate Hannah, but I couldn't imagine that they weren't out there, just hidden from my sight by their picket fence and the neighbor's hedge. I started to slow. I didn't want to risk hitting Micaiah with the car. We were barely half a block away. I was going to have to abort. And then he swung her up over his head again, dancing around in a circle. He didn't even look at us, though he had to have heard the engine. He was having too much fun. On the hood of my car, Aurieli remained crouched, knees slightly bent. There wasn't another wolf in the pack that I would even have thought of asking to try this in human form. I wasn't asking Aurieli just to survive the accident. I was asking her to keep 6-year-old Micaiah safe. But I'd seen her fight a volcano god. I was reasonably certain that if anyone outside a movie could do this, it would be Aurieli. Even so, I wouldn't have tried it. Except that even when I'd turned the corner and he'd been 6 blocks away, I could read madness in the enemy wolf's body language. I'd grown up in the Morox pack, where every year, people who had been newly changed failed to control their wolf. Some of them went completely mad. I'd probably seen a dozen of them, but one would have been enough. They were scary enough to imprint on my brain the first time. If I'd had any doubt, the expression on the face of the man holding Micaiah would have cleared it right up. Whether Lincoln Stewart, I recognized him from Adam's photo presentation, lived or died today, he was never going to have a human heart again. I could see Hannah and Kelly now. Hannah, a scarlet streak across one shoulder, was frozen just inside the gate. Kelly was on the grass, elbow crawling toward her. And then the time for observation was over. Aurieli launched herself, stretching out in the instant before the Jetta hit the werewolf. He was tall, so the bumper caught him just below the knee, obliterating the bone. The sound was loud, but dull, as if I'd hit something soft. The velocity folded him sideways over the hood as the car crushed him into the dumpster. The seatbelt holding me in my seat gave up the ghost. I'd been worried about that. It was on my list to fix. Even so, the car crumpled as it had been designed to do, absorbing a good bit of the power of the collision. The seatbelt held on long enough that I didn't go through the windshield. The impact rang my bell pretty good, and maybe broke my nose on the steering wheel. There was enough blood for that, and my nose hurt sufficiently. Dazed, I backed the car up until it died, about 6 feet from the dumpster, which had not moved with the impact. I popped the door open and struggled out amid dripping glass. I had to spin around awkwardly once to get rid of the remains of the seatbelt. The car was more damaged than I'd expected. Maybe the speedometer had needed some work. I stared at the car for a moment and decided the speedometer was a moot point. I was going to be looking for another car again. About that time, I realized I could hear a lot of noise and that there were a lot more important things going on than the wreck of my car. I pulled out my gun and stepped around the car to point it at Lincoln, who was howling and snarling and trying to pull the remains of his left leg out of my radiator where it was caught. That both of his legs were hideously broken did not apparently register, because in among the other sounds he was making were threats. They seemed pretty undirected at the moment, but I believed him. I'd seen this kind of behavior before. Pain meant nothing to someone who was lost in his wolf. But then his shirt slid back, and I saw a wound on the top of his shoulder. My breathing was labored, because I had to breathe through my mouth because of my nose. I was starting to think, as the shock of the collision, I could hardly term it an accident, receded a bit, that I had broken a rib or two as well. Woozy as I was, I couldn't afford to take my eyes off Lincoln. The shirt slid a little more, and I saw a second scab on his skin where another tooth had penetrated. They weren't small holes, like the rabbit bite that Ben and I had gotten. These were bigger,
more like the photos that Marsilia had sent of Stefan's wounds. As much as I wanted to go rip the shirt off to be sure, I didn't dare go any nearer to him. He might be bitten, but he was also a werewolf. "Micaiah," I called. "Arielle?" "Safe," said Arielle, sounding remarkably composed. The sounds had died down to just children crying near and far, and Lincoln's frenzy. "Injuries?" I asked. "Micaiah looks like she has a broken wrist and maybe an ankle," Arielle said. "Hannah has a bad cut on her shoulder that will need stitches, a lot of stitches. Kelly..."
"We'll survive," he growled. "Changing now."
"Any bites?" I asked. "This wolf has been bitten like Ben." Arielle said something pungent. After a moment, relief in her voice, she said, "Not Micaiah, not Hannah. Kelly?"
"No," said Kelly. "He hit me with a baseball bat. Then he hit me with my tool chest."
"And the sledgehammer," said Hannah, sounding broken.
"And the sledgehammer, but no bites. We'll survive," said Kelly again. "No bites, Mercy."
I was pretty sure the last word he said was my name, but Kelly's voice had dropped and lost clarity because he was changing. Shifting to wolf and food should fix most of it over the next couple of days, as long as nothing was misaligned. I had to trust Arielle to make sure Kelly would be okay too. My job was to figure out what to do with this wolf. I had my gun and my cutlass, which was still in its case in the car, but I couldn't just kill him. Not here in the open with door cameras and cell phone cameras. I could see some curtains moving at Kelly's neighbor's house. He hadn't killed anyone here for anyone to see. Broken by the impact with my car, he appeared not to be an immediate threat. He was, especially with those bite marks. But the human authorities wouldn't know that if I killed him. And if I waited until he was up on his feet, he might manage to kill me. "What about the other kids?" Arielle asked. Not me, obviously. "Safe," said Hannah. "Sean and Patrick are at a friend's house. I locked the baby in our bedroom. She's not happy, but she's safe." Sean and Patrick were their two boys, ages 12 and 10. The baby was 3, so not really a baby anymore. A truck drove up. I didn't look up from Lincoln, but I heard it just fine. A late model Ford diesel, I thought, from the sounds of it. It didn't belong to any of the pack. I knew the sounds of the pack's vehicles. The truck stopped across the street, and a pair of doors opened. I heard 3 people get out of the truck and stop on the other side of the road. 3 people who were werewolves, and not our werewolves. I wasn't smelling them.